What's wrong?
I need something stronger.
Take 4 red capsules. In 10 minutes, take 2 more. Help is on the way.
You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
That Rothschild comes on the scene in what, the late 17th century?
Yes.
Now, Bank of England existed before he came around.
Oh, indeed it did.
But he's the one that really made it as notorious as it is to this day, did he?
Right. Yeah, William of Orange, of course, had a lot to do with that bank. It was really a transfer of power in England, from the Wetton family to the Windsor family, essentially, and that's where we are today. Not much has changed in that regard. The statement attributed to Rothschild, so give me the power to coin a nation's money and I care not who makes its laws, that really is the essence of their existence. So, to them, it really doesn't matter who's in charge as long as they're the ones creating the money.
Such is the power of these central banks that they soon take total control over a nation's economy. It soon amounts to nothing but a plutocracy, ruled by the rich. It would be like putting control of the army in the hands of the mafia. The danger of tyranny would be extreme. Yes, we need central banks. No, we do not need them in private hands. The central bank scam is really a hidden tax. The nation sells bonds to the central bank to pay for things it does not have the political will to raise taxes to pay for. But the bonds are purchased with money the central bank creates out of nothing. More money in circulation makes your money worth less. The government gets as much money as it needs, and the people pay for it in inflation. The beauty of the plan is that not one person in 1,000 can figure it out, because it's usually hidden behind complex-sounding economics gibberish. With the formation of the Bank of England, the nation was soon awash in money. Prices throughout the country doubled. Massive loans were granted for just about any wild scheme. One venture proposed to drain the Red Sea to recover gold supposedly lost when the Egyptian army drowned pursuing Moses and the Israelites. By 1698, government debt grew from the initial £1.25 million to £16 million. Naturally, taxes were increased and then increased again to pay for all of this. With the British money supply firmly in their grip, the British economy began a wild roller coaster series of booms and depressions, exactly the sort of thing a central bank claims it is determined to prevent.
There are two things which I think are intrinsic not just to the Bank of England, but to central banking generally. The first is an involvement in the formulation of monetary policy with the specific objective of achieving monetary stability.
However, since the Bank of England took control, the British pound has rarely been stable.
Rothschild.
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 Rothschild. Rothschild.
By the mid-1700s, the British Empire was nearing its height of power around the world. But Britain had fought 4 costly wars in Europe since the creation of their privately owned central bank, the Bank of England. The cost had been high. To finance these wars, the British Parliament here had borrowed heavily from the bank. By the mid-1700s, the government's debt here in Britain was £140 million, a staggering sum for those days. Consequently, the British government embarked on a program of trying to raise revenues from their American colonies in order to make their interest payments to the bank. But in America, it was a different story. The scourge of a privately owned central bank had not yet hit. This is Independence Hall in Philadelphia, where the Declaration of Independence and Constitution were signed. In the mid-1700s, pre-revolutionary America was still relatively poor.
there was a severe shortage of precious metal coins to trade for goods, so the early colonists were forced to experiment with printing their own homegrown paper money. Some of these experiments were successful. Franklin was a big supporter of the colonies printing their own paper money.
In 1757, Franklin was sent to London. He ended up staying for the next 18 years here, nearly until the start of the American Revolution. During this period, the American colonies began to issue their own money. Called colonial scrip, the endeavor was very successful. It provided a reliable medium of exchange, and it also helped to provide a feeling of unity between the colonies. Remember, colonial scrip was just paper money, debt-free money printed in the public interest and not backed by gold or silver coin. In other words, it was a totally fiat currency. One day, officials of the Bank of England asked Franklin how he would account for the newfound prosperity of the colonies. Without hesitation, he replied,
"That is simple. In the colonies, we issue our own money. It is called colonial scrip. We issue it in proper proportion to the demands of trade and industry to make the products pass easily from the producers to the consumers. In this manner, creating for ourselves our own paper money, we control its purchasing power, and we have no interest to pay to no one."
This was just common sense to Franklin, but you can imagine the impact it had on the Bank of England. America had learned the secret of money, and that genie had to be returned to its bottle as soon as possible. As a result, Parliament hurriedly passed the Currency Act of 1764. This prohibited colonial officials from issuing their own money and ordered them to pay all future taxes in gold or silver coins. In other words, it forced the colonies on a gold or silver standard. For those who still believe that a gold standard is the answer for America's current monetary problems, look what happened to America after that. Writing in his autobiography, Franklin said,
"In 1 year, the conditions were so reversed that the era of prosperity ended and a depression set in to such an extent that the streets of the colonies were filled with unemployed."
Franklin claims that this was even the basic cause for the American Revolution.
As Franklin put it in his autobiography,
"The colonies would gladly have borne a little tax on tea and other matters had it not been that England took away from the colonies their money, which created unemployment and dissatisfaction. The inability of the colonists to get the power to issue their own money permanently out of the hands of George III and the international bankers was the prime reason for the Revolutionary War."
By the time the first shots were fired in Lexington, Massachusetts, on April 19, 1775, the colonies had been drained of gold and silver coin by British taxation.
"The rich will strive to establish their dominion and enslave the rest. They always did. They always will."
As a result, the Continental government had no choice but to print money to finance the war. At the start of the Revolution, the U.S. money supply stood at $12 million. By the end of the war, it was nearly $500 million. As a result, the currency was virtually worthless. Shoes sold for $5,000 a pair. Colonial scrip had worked because just enough was issued to facilitate trade. As George Washington lamented, "A wagon load of money will scarcely purchase a wagon load of provisions."
Today, those who support a gold-backed currency point to this period during the Revolution to demonstrate the evils of a fiat currency. But remember, the same currency had worked so well 20 years earlier during times of peace that the Bank of England had Parliament outlaw it.
The Bank of England was clearly identified as the instigator of these troubles, if you will. Clearly identified. But yet, all through the Revolution, when George Washington is our commander-in-chief, what do we find in his portfolio? Bank of England stock. All through the revolution, he owned the stock of the Bank of England. And that's exactly what George Washington had. He owned stock in the Bank of England and had it in his portfolio throughout the revolution. Now, once the revolution is over, the very provisions that were in the Articles of Confederation, remember, this is the pre-Constitution document, where the Congress had the power to emit bills of credit, to issue paper money. It was clearly given to the Congress, this power, in the Articles of Confederation. Well, it was Washington's job and Hamilton's job to remove that provision and to make sure that there was provision to pay all of the debts that may have been incurred because, honestly, both sides of this endeavor were financed by the very same people. So I don't think King George had any clue that the Rothschild interests were also financing the other side of the war. If he did, I'm sure he would have treated them a little differently.
Rothschild.
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 Rothschild. Rothschild.
Alexander Hamilton comes onto the scene as a double agent, effectively, and convinces George Washington, whom I'm starting to have my doubts about, George's, you know.
Yeah, more on that later. Yeah, you're right.
Because immediately, you know, 1792, 20 minutes after the nation was founded, Alexander Hamilton proposes that he and his friends be allowed to control the nation's money. And they established the Bank of the United States with George Washington's blessing. And the Bank of the United States is granted a 20-year charter for the purpose of managing or maintaining the nation's money supply. So in that 20-year period, Hamilton's successors pretty much amass control of every industry and every bit of commerce in the new country. And so when the time comes to renew the charter in 1812, Congress says no. And suddenly the British decide they're going to start harassing shipping and impressing seamen, etc. Next thing you know, we're at war with the British again. Well, the bottom line is that it was the British that controlled the Bank of the United States. It was for this reason that they didn't mind giving us our independence, because they knew, you know, give me control over a nation's money and I don't care who makes the laws. So with the roots of the Bank of the United States deeply founded in the Bank of England, in effect, we didn't win the revolution. We simply won a part of our freedom. And our monetary freedom was something that the president at the time and Congress felt real strongly that we should have. So they cancel this charter. We go to war with England. And by 1814, after Washington has been sacked, after the White House, which wasn't white then, it was, burned, and we had to paint it white, after the White House was burned, after Dolly Madison has to flee Washington with the Constitution and Declaration of Independence secreted in her luggage, then the British decide, okay, we're going to go home. What changed? Well, the only thing that changed was that the Congress decided to recharter the Second Bank of the United States in 1814. And for that period from 1814 to 1834, we lived in relative peace with England, and we grew a little bit in terms of industry. But the real change came when Andrew Jackson showed up on the scene and said, look, you vote for me, and I will kill this bank. If you want to keep this bank, then don't vote for me, because if you vote for me, I'm going to kill this bank.
On June 18, 1815, 74,000 French troops met 67,000 troops from Britain and other European nations. The outcome was certainly in doubt. In fact, had Napoleon attacked a few hours earlier, he would probably have won the battle. But no matter who won or lost, back in London, Nathan Rothschild planned to use the opportunity to try to seize control over the British stock and bond market, and possibly even the Bank of England. Rothschild stationed a trusted agent, a man named Rothworth, on the north side of the battlefield, closer to the English Channel.
Once the battle had been decided, Rothworth took off for the Channel.
He delivered the news to Nathan Rothschild a full 24 hours before Wellington's own courier. Rothschild hurried to the stock market and took up his usual position in front of an ancient pillar. All eyes were on him. The Rothschilds had a legendary communications network. If Wellington had been defeated and Napoleon was loose on the continent again, Britain's financial situation would become grave indeed. Rothschild looked saddened. He stood there motionless, eyes downcast. Then suddenly he began selling. Other nervous investors saw that Rothschild was selling. It could only mean one thing. Napoleon must have won, Wellington must have lost. The market plummeted. Soon everyone was selling their consols, their British government bonds, and prices dropped sharply. But then Rothschild started secretly buying up the consols through his agents for only a fraction of their worth hours before.
Myths, legends, you say? 100 years later, the New York Times ran a story which said that Nathan's grandson had attempted to secure a court order to suppress a book with this stock market story in it. The Rothschild family claimed the story was untrue and libelous, but the court denied the Rothschild's request and ordered the family to pay all court costs.
What's even more interesting about this story is that some authors claim that the day after the Battle of Waterloo, in a matter of hours, Nathan Rothschild came to dominate not only the bond market, but the Bank of England as well. Whether or not the Rothschild family seized control of the Bank of England, the first privately owned central bank in a major European nation and the wealthiest, one thing is certain. By the mid-1800s, the Rothschilds were the richest family in the world, bar none. They dominated the new government bond markets and branched into other banks and industrial concerns.
In fact, the rest of the 19th century was known as the Age of the Rothschilds. Despite this overwhelming wealth, the family has generally cultivated an aura of invisibility. Although the family controls scores of industrial, commercial, mining, and tourist corporations, only a handful bear the Rothschild name. By the end of the 19th century, one expert estimated that the Rothschild family controlled half the wealth of the world. Whatever the extent of their vast wealth, it is reasonable to assume that their percentage of the world's wealth has increased since then. But since the turn of the century, the Rothschilds have cultivated the notion that their power has somehow waned even as their wealth increases.
Rothschild.
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 While Alexander Hamilton was doing all of his things to get his Bank of the United States established and the Bank of New York, incidentally, which was his personal project, see, he got his own personal reward by being given charter for the Bank of New York, and the Rothschilds got their payoff by getting the Bank of the United States. Well, and then they, to the exclusion of everyone else, these were the only two institutions that were allowed to exist. Well, unbeknownst to Hamilton or to the Rothschild interest, Alexander Hamilton chartered the Manhattan Water Company with the idea that we're going to provide water for Manhattan. Who could be opposed to that? But tucked into the little charter in there, he gave himself the right to do anything else that was legal to do. And one of those things would be to establish a bank. And so he did. And so today that Chase Bank, the Chase Manhattan Bank, the Manhattan Water Company became Manufacturers Hanover, became what is today Chase Bank.
The natural course of power is to make the many slaves to the few, one anti-federalist wrote. Another objected to the new government because the bulk of the people can have nothing to say to it. The government is not a government of the people. The men of fortune would not feel for the common people. An aristocratical tyranny would arise in which the great will struggle for power, honor, and wealth. The poor become a prey to avarice, insolence, and oppression. In short, my fellow citizens, it can be said to be nothing less than a nasty stride to universal empire.
The history I look back into tells me that presidents who screw with the money wind up getting killed themselves. And didn't Jackson actually survive an attempt?
Several.
Right.
Several assassinations.
In fact, the one poor soul, I shouldn't say that because he was an assassin.
Both pistols misfired. Like he couldn't get a shot off. It's almost as if there was divine intervention in that regard. And, but the problem in the Jackson issue is that they overplayed their hand. What Jackson was saying is that this bank is so evil, it controls everything in this country. They take care of their friends, they punish their enemies, they don't play fair, and I want to get rid of them. Well, in their zealousness and overzealousness to not make sure that Jackson was not reelected, they overplayed their hand. And so the people quickly saw, wait a minute, that's exactly what Jackson said. Look, every editor is against him. Every banker is against him. Every man of industry and woman of industry is against him. So he must be right. Let's vote for him. And they did. And when Jackson got in, he did exactly what he said he was going to do. He killed the bank and created for the first time in the nation's history a legitimate sub-treasury system where the Treasury of the United States was responsible for the issue of all money. And in going back to your original question, in that period from 1834 to just before the Civil War, 1861, the nation was abuzz with industry. There was plenty of money. There was plenty of activity. And this was the most prosperous period in the nation's history when we had our own monetary system. I mean, if you just look at the presidency, in the summer of 1963, in June of 1963, John Kennedy said, the idea of the nation having its own money is a wonderful concept, and so I'm going to put a man on the moon and, you know, rebuild America's society. Many of the programs of Johnson were, in fact, Kennedy's programs. And in doing so, he went to United States notes. Now, those of you who were around in the summer of 1963 might remember these things. They were red. They had a red seal instead of a green seal. Mm. And across the top, instead of saying Federal Reserve note, they said United States note. Huh. So this difference is simply this, that a Federal Reserve note is issued by the privately owned Federal Reserve banks. A United States note is issued by the Treasury. A Federal Reserve note costs nothing to make, virtually nothing. A United States note costs nothing to make. But when Congress issues a United States note, the $100 bill or a $5 bill that costs them 3 cents to make and then puts it into circulation, no one benefits except the people, because the profit between the cost to manufacture the bill and the base value of the bill stays in the Treasury. But what the Federal Reserve has enacted is this wonderful little system where instead of issuing United States notes, Congress issues a bond. I owe you $1,000. Then they hand that bond to the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve creates 10 $100 bills and hands it back to Congress. And then they get the interest on the bond. Mm-hmm. Kennedy saw the wrong in that, and so issued United States notes in June of 63. Well, a lone nut assassinated him, and lo and behold, in November of 1963, these notes were withdrawn. So they circulated for that very short period. Okay, maybe that's a coincidence, so let's back up in history and look at McKinley, you know, who did the very same thing, issued United States notes, the Bison note. McKinley met with an untimely death. Garfield issued United States notes. He met with an untimely death. Well, is there anyone else we can point to? Well, how about the very first president to issue unbacked paper currency? And that would be Abraham Lincoln, who said that the power to issue paper money was the greatest blessing of this republic. And unfortunately, a lone nut took him out as well. So it seems that every president that's been assassinated or lost his life in office did so only after issuing United States notes. And this, to me, is too much of a coincidence.
Turning to the United States, Dr. Quigley tells us, The structure of financial controls created by the tycoons of big banking and big business in the period 1880 to 1933 was of extraordinary complexity. One business fief being built on another, both being allied with semi-independent associates, the whole rearing upward into two pinnacles of economic and financial power. One, centered in New York, was headed by J.P. Morgan and Company, and the other, in Ohio, was headed by the Rockefeller family. When these two cooperated, as they generally did, they could influence the economic life of the country to a large degree and could almost control its political life, at least on the federal level. In the United States, it was inevitable that the international banking interests would attempt to establish the same kind of private monopoly over the money system that they had achieved in England, France, Germany, Italy, and Switzerland. The same formula would be used: make it look like a government operation, but keep the control in private hands. John D. Rockefeller had purchased the Chase Bank, and his brother William bought the National City Bank of New York. The Rockefeller Chase Bank was later merged with the Warburg's Manhattan Bank to form the Chase Manhattan, one of the most powerful financial combines in the world today. Acting in concert with the Morgan banking dynasty, they spent untold millions of dollars to promote legislation that would grant to them a private franchise over this nation's money system. To sell this scheme to the voters, the monopolists created the propaganda line that the proposed banking law somehow would work against the monopolies.
Tired of foreclosures, financial ruin, and oppressive governmental tyranny over your fundamental personal freedoms? Do you sometimes feel like dropping everything and storming into Washington? Standing on the great lawn and screaming until someone does something, anything. Well, try Never Mind It All. It's the soothing medication that takes all that frustration and anger and pushes it away like an iron fist, so you can get back to doing exactly what is expected of you. Never Mind It All. Get the relief and liberation without the representation. Rise up with Never Mind It All.
Politicians took up the cry, "Banking reform," and "Down with Wall Street." And then, to make it look convincing, the financial tycoons publicly pretended to oppose the measure, all the while financing it behind the scenes. On December 22, 1913, the Federal Reserve Act finally was passed into law. Something known as the Federal Reserve System came into being, and with it, total control over the nation's money fell into private hands.
The rich will strive to establish their dominion and enslave the rest. They always did. They always will.
Give me your money. You only biological flow.